This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast. In this episode, we're delighted to share Stephanie Eslake speaking with composer Thomas Misson in Hobart, Tasmania.
Hi, this is Stephanie Eslake, and you're listening to Making Conversation, the new podcast series from Making Waves, in which we introduce you to a new Australian composer. Today, we're in the city of Hobart with Thomas Misson. Hi, Thomas. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
So, tell us a bit about your background. Were you born in Tasmania?
Yes, I was. Been in Hobart the whole time, and very fidgety as a kid, and so I started piano when I was about 12, and as soon as I picked up a musical instrument, I sort of had found a way to, you know, channel that sort of unsettled anxiety, and I just sort of ran with it from there.
How old were you when you started playing piano?
I was 12.
How old are you now?
I just turned 24.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
With piano as your main instrument, I'm wondering when you realised that you had talent in composition as well.
Well, it was sort of a lack of talent for practising that led me to just muck around a lot. Like, I think I had just a lot of music to get out of me, and it wasn't necessarily someone else's music. I did piano sort of only up until the end of year 12, when I thought, you know, I should really write down, you know, what I'm doing and have a serious go at writing a piece. And yeah, I tried to get it played at play it at speech night and at Hutchins, and they said, oh no, what about that Rachmaninoff you've been playing? I sort of really didn't want to. I really, you know, it felt a bit disingenuous as a performance experience. You know, I felt attached to the Rachmaninoff, but I didn't really feel like it was an honest musical expression, and that made me very frustrated that I couldn't get it performed. Then they said, go with the classical stuff. And so that was the first thing that led me towards composition. The second was when I got to the con, I got in on piano, but not only did I find out that I probably couldn't play anything that I'd written, but also I couldn't keep my piano teacher, Victoria Burley, who I grew very attached to her approach, you know, very, very detail oriented. You would do maybe the subject of a Bach fugue for one lesson, if you're lucky, you know, like it's just incredible, incredible attention to detail and construction and that sort of thing. So in a very immature snap decision, I thought I'm going to change major and do composition. And I was yet to pour these sort of musical rants and extended improvisation sessions into a disciplined form, you know, so I wasn't very good at it at first. I remember getting some marks that were a bit touch and go.
Did you start to resent the piano in this time of not being able to take it in the direction that you had wanted to?
The relationship with the instruments only changed recently, but for, you know, at that time, the relationship with the instrument was the same. It was just discovering what sort of musical being I was exactly, you know, having a love of improvising and, you know, very quickly a love of composition. And, you know, I was curious about other things. I was really curious about conducting, and I was really curious about, you know, other instruments and that sort of thing. I didn't exactly know what I was. It was a bit of an identity crisis. So, I mean, after that, for about 5 years, I went through a kind of phase where I thought, okay, I'll kind of be a double major type thing. So I got up really, really early, didn't have my license at the time. So I got up and got the bus at about 6 o'clock and went into the con and practiced and turned up to my 9 a.m. lecture with a couple of hours of practice under my belt, and then did my composition work and then stayed there, you know, after dinner, I went and did more practice for a couple of hours and stayed there really late.
Have you ever suffered a burnout?
Oh, yeah, like massively. Yeah, like there's lots of days where I was doing about 10 hours of work, I think.
How do you control that now and also come out of that sense of exhaustion once you realise you've pushed yourself a bit too far?
You know, if you're not really living, you've got nothing to write about. You know, you just sort of, if you're not, you know, doing a bit of, I don't know, travel, or you're not outside, or you're not, you know, you're not sort of out in the real world at least a little bit, you know, I think your writing becomes quite stagnant, and so does your performing. But how I'm controlling that now is I'm actually looking to phase out of piano. Yeah, I'm sort of phasing out of piano stuff at the moment. I've got, you know, lots of accompaniment work I'm getting through, but once I'm through that, I really want to focus on composing for quite a while. Like I feel like performing and getting an instrument to a reasonably high level is, you know, has been a really important part of my musical diet, but I feel like I don't really need it anymore. I love to play, and I love to pick pieces apart and you know, try and squeeze every last bit of the composer's intention out of the piece. But when I get up there to perform, I feel fraudulent, but also I only get the unpleasant side of performance nerves, really. You know, it's just like, thank God that's over at the end. It's not like, yay, I get to share music with the world. It's like, you know, hope I can make less than 3 mistakes, you know, or, yeah, you know, it, you know, becomes almost like a sport, you know.
It's, yeah. In that kind of pursuit of doing what you really want to do, which is composition, and sort of phasing out piano and closing that door while you're quite young as well, do you feel any concerns about halting a career path, like accompaniment or performance, and exploring other opportunities? Like, how do you sort of feel about that?
I think I'm ready to let piano be a more occasional part of my musical life. You know, I've done it for 12 years, and it's given me, I think it's run its course as far as what it can do for my for my composing. You know, like I will definitely, you know, if someone says, hey, I want to play this new Australian work, you know, then I'll probably jump at it. But for most accompaniment opportunities, they sort of don't really appeal to me anymore.
Mm.
And, you know, it wears pretty thin trying to keep both disciplines at a high level. It's really, yeah, it's truly exhausting. Like it's, yeah.
What is it about Australian and new Australian music specifically, aside from being a composer yourself, but you mentioned the idea of performing other compositions by new Australian composers. What is it that draws you to those more than, for instance, Rachmaninoff?
I think we have to forge ahead. Contemporary classical has developed this sort of incredible diversity that you know, people go their whole lives, you know, without experiencing. They think it might, you know, a lot of people think it sort of stops at Debussy and the rest is just people faffing about with random notes. But it's not true. I remember the last history unit at the con, there wasn't a listening exam because the amount of diversity in contemporary classical music exceeds that of all the history units that came before it combined. You know, it's impossible to get Philip Glass mixed up with Xenakis, mixed up with Addis, mixed up with Ligeti.
Mm.
You know, it's just, yeah, they're almost their own separate genres. And I think people are more, I think there's a larger audience for the music than people think.
Mm.
You know, the popularity of the MOFO and Dark MOFO festivals, you know, say to me that people do want to be, you know, a lot of people do want to be challenged and surprised and discover completely new sounds yeah, I think we've just got to, I think classical music has to keep developing. Yeah.
So where does Thomas Misson fit into this new sound and new genre?
I don't know. My process for developing my style has been, I kind of listen to and used to play a lot of composers that just sort of spoke to me immediately or aroused my curiosity. And then outside of that, I just find lots of things I don't understand and sort of try and come to terms with them and see if they have an organic place in my style and just sort of keep including them. So I do a fair bit of study of other classical contemporary composers. So I suppose eventually it'll take on something sort of personal and individual. But you know, I'm not pressuring myself to have a style or any form of originality in my 20s and maybe not even in my 30s. You know, like I can really relate to sort of Elliot Carter, who was still talking about bits of his compositional style he wanted to improve, you know, well into his 90s. You know, it's not like performing where there's a bit of a physical sort of timer on it all, but what repertoire you can manage, you know, what your body can actually handle. But I think composers sort of develop forever.
Outside of your studies at the University of Tasmania, where you finished a Bachelor of Music with first class honours, you've been commissioned by an impressive number of groups, some of which include the Tasmanian Discovery Orchestra, Hobart Wind Symphony, Derwent Strings and Derwent Valley Concert Band. How have you found the experience of taking on such large-scale commissions so early in your career?
Particularly with Derwent Strings, it's been really good for going back to, you know, the basics in terms of writing for each and every instrument. You know, sort of borrowed, you know, a few instruments to kind of get to grips with them and test out my writing on them and that sort of thing. So it's been really good to have that hands-on experience, but also seeing what the maximum amount of value you can give the players for their level of experience. So Derwent Strings, I think they're about aiming to be a grade 4 average standard, and it was interesting to see what you could actually give them in terms of, you know, color and you know, different techniques and you know, things they probably hadn't done with their instruments before or heard before with their instruments. It was really interesting seeing what you could get out of them. Yeah, it's really fun.
Yeah. What have you learned through these experiences about attracting new commissions as a composer?
Nothing, I guess. I mean, I think just, you know, do a good job, be nice to people and hope for the best, you know.
Do you think that being in Tasmania has helped your career? Like, is it a very supportive place for composers here?
I think it is.
Who are some of the other Tasmanian composers that you really look up to or who influence your work?
More than anyone else, probably Scott McIntyre. He was my composition teacher in first year, and this is when I thought that Debussy and Ravel were, you know, the most radical musical explorers, you know, you could possibly imagine. And so I think, yeah, I think when I had him, I wasn't sort of quite ready in a lot of ways, but now, you know, now a lot of what he told me makes so much sense, but speaks to me on a very personal level. And yeah, I've flocked to, you know, every performance of every piece of his, and, you know, bought scores and that sort of thing. It's just, yeah, he's an absolutely fantastic composer with so much respect for tradition, but also recontextualizing that tradition, you know, how we can move ahead from that. It kind of keeps me from, you know, abstaining from, you know, Baroque and Romantic and, you know, older styles of music. You know, it helps me to find so much more value in them, you know, as well as new works.
How do you think that being a Tasmanian composer has affected your musical identity or the way that others see you?
I think the environment and the type of place that Hobart is has affected it quite a bit. We have a lot of peace and quiet in Hobart compared to sort of Melbourne and Sydney, and I think that's definitely affected how I feel about space in music. I'm not generally affected by nature in my music just yet, although I do like to personalize pieces when I write for others. I wrote a solo violin piece for Emily Shepherd recently. She performed at Alexandra Battery a few weeks ago, and she's right into, you know, environmental science and very environmentally conscious and loves nature. So I sort of put quite a lot of natural touches in that.
How does that translate in a musical sense?
I guess sort of there's plenty of bird song in it, and there's sort of imitation of sounds coming from, you know, the vegetation, you know, either with, you know, animals in it or you know, against other vegetation, you know, sort of wind sounds and that sort of thing.
And all for solo violin, this was?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
What's the name of the piece?
Kunyani Ascent. Mm-hmm. So it was written about when I first got my license. So the morning after, you know, in a kind of slightly uncontrolled urge for freedom, you know, I sort of went to the top of Mount Wellington to do some writing, actually. And I wanted to do it at sunrise because I wanted to go somewhere where, you know, a landscape sort of changes and evolves over the course of an hour, you know, sort of thing. And because I wanted to incorporate more of that into my sort of musical environments, if you will. But I wrote a few things down and I put them aside for a year, and I thought, you know, like I was waiting for a home for those ideas. And then Emily Shepherd said she wanted a violin piece, and I said, well, you know, she's... she loves nature and the environment. So I think that's sort of the home for these ideas.
Mm. Tell us a bit more about your other compositions. So I'm particularly interested to hear the story behind this strangely named Saturday Night Tuberculosis. How did this come about?
So this was the progressive rock side of my musical upbringing. shouting at the audience a bit. Jack Barnes, a friend of mine who I went through the con with, we both, you know, we discovered that we were both enamored with, you know, progressive rock of all different styles and ages. But we'd, you know, when we first met, we'd also discovered that there was kind of a midpoint between progressive rock and classical music. And there's actually a couple of Australian composers who sort of fall into that category. And if you look at the piano sonatas of Carl Vine and Nigel Westlake, and if anyone's listening, please listen to the second string quartet of Nigel Westlake. But yeah, it's sort of got this, you know, they've all got this kind of groove, I suppose, you can really, you know, headbang to. Like, there's not much difference between these, you know, quartets and sonatas and being at a progressive rock gig of some sort. It's only a matter of instrumentation and amplification and getting a big crowd. And, you know, that's really the only differences. So yeah, he asked for a piece and he said that he wanted it to be, you know, have lots and lots of progressive rock in it. He wanted it to be very groove driven and very rhythmic and very headbangy. And so I started that, writing that sort of beginning of 2014, and I was one of those pieces that there was sort of no hurry for, so I just sort of kept coming back. It took almost a year, even though it's only 4 minutes, 5 minutes long. And how I got to the name, because it's, you know, effectively progressive rock, sort of some dance styles and classical music, I thought it reminded me a little bit of disco music in some bits. I thought of some kind of puns off Saturday Night Fever. And then I kind of, just as a nod towards sort of primitivism, but also just, you know, it's got a lot of clusters in it. It's got a lot of very, very primitive kind of sounding effects in it. So, that's sort of where I came up with tuberculosis, I guess. But, you know, hindsight is 2020, so.
Is this sort of progressive rock or headbangy sort of music, as you call it, something that you would like to see more in the concert hall?
Oh, definitely. I think at the conservatory, when we've got this sort of segregation of classical and contemporary students, and look, we do try, but for the most part, when we're talking about music, at least, there's a bit of a, you know, it can be difficult to relate to each other. And I think, you know, given there are plenty of Prokofiev, Stravinsky, Ynastira, Bartok fans around, and there are plenty of hard rock, progressive rock, metal, you know, new metal, art rock, baroque rock, you know, all sorts of different, well, not just rock, but, you know, dance styles as well, and funk as well, you know. Given that there is on both sides so much affinity for rhythmic drive and that sort of thing, I'm surprised that there's not more of it around. Mm. Yeah.
You also teach students yourself at Hobart College. You teach composition there. Is this sort of breaking the boundaries of genre and style? Is that something that you'd like to pass on to your composition students as a message?
I suppose so, but the what's more important to me is developing a sense of skepticism and a sense of kind of infinity, I guess, with music, that it doesn't stop, like the possibilities don't stop, and the development, you know, of it doesn't stop and shouldn't stop.
Do you feel confident for your composition students' future and your own future as a young composer composing in Australia, like in terms of career stability and making a life out of your art?
Not really. Yeah, look, there's a lot of really well-funded musical bodies who just won't program Australian music. I think it's quite artistically conservative sometimes.
Mm.
And that makes it really difficult for composers who don't have any sort of natural affinity for a more popular style, which I can't do it. It comes out really false and, you know. I think it depends on where you are stylistically, really.
Mm.
Yeah.
What sort of changes would you like to see happen?
I don't think people would miss one Mozart or Beethoven symphony taken out of their program. You know, I don't think they would miss it. I think it's really incremental. I don't think we actually have to do much.
Obsession by Thomas Misson, and you heard Alethea Coombs, Jack Barnes, and Matt Brennan. You also wrote another composition this year, one of your more recent ones, called Obsession, which was for violin, vibraphone, and piano. Tell us a bit about this one.
Yeah, it was perhaps the shortest creative process of any piece I've ever had. I had about 3 weeks to get it ready from start to finish, which was interesting.
Was that while you were studying?
Yeah.
Full load.
Yeah, well, honours too. second semester of honours. So.
And you still came out with first class. Very well done.
Obviously I'm still recovering. I've been wanting to experiment with sort of rhythmic cycling, sort of like what Ligeti does, layering patterns of different lengths over each other with the same sort of smallest value, like having, you know, nine quavers, a pattern of nine quavers looping over a pattern of seven quavers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they miss a line. But also wanting to explore sort of harmonic possibilities of that, you know, by having a stable harmony, but with like a really unstable rhythmic profile. So you might have, you know, a chord that only has four or five notes in it, and both patterns have exclusively notes from that chord, but it kind of the texture itself moves. So I sort of placed melodies on top of that, and sometimes meeting or bouncing off notes of that unstable background texture.
Mm.
But it was also kind of a tribute to Ligeti, one of my sort of bigger influences, who'd been dead 10 years by the time it was finished.
How do you see the role of new Australian music in our landscape today?
I think people would genuinely suffer in this country without new music. You know, if we heard the same thing, I think people would underestimate just how mad it would drive people if it weren't a constantly moving and evolving climate. The role that new music has to play is more widespread than just leisure and recreation and enjoyment. I think it goes right down to physical health.
Mm. Do you feel secure for the future of young composers?
I don't think anybody in music is really secure in terms of career opportunity. You know, it's a very tough thing to stick with it long enough and to work hard enough at it to get to a place where you are. But in terms of the climate for Australian composers, I think that, yeah, there are some very small changes that would be really helpful, you know, sort of, you know, maybe from the ground up, you know, more emphasis on music appreciation rather than musical achievement sort of at a younger age and opening up their minds to, you know, as many different musical styles and possibilities and just teaching them where music actually has a place in society and how pervasive it is. I think here we're probably a little bit behind in those stakes, you know, in terms of how they teach it elsewhere, particularly in Europe. And I think if we can address that from the ground up, then yeah, I think composers and performers will feel just that little bit safer in terms of their future.
Mm. And thank you very much for being a part of this scene of new music in Australia, Thomas.
Thanks, Steph.
You've been listening to Making Conversation as part of Making Waves, and please tune in for the next podcast. Thanks very much for listening.
The Making Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, project patron Cameron Lamb of Camaclan, and Creative Partnerships Australia's match funding program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron-Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney and Peggy Polias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Malena Radice and Mark Wolfe. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Elia Simic-Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support.